Jenny was a woman of faith. There's just no doubt about it. Beyond her possible understanding, and certainly beyond ours. As I said earlier, because of her experience with depression, she was not at all afraid of the cancer, and was not afraid, indeed, to die. When I told her that she had cancer, her strange words, not immediate, but with a very small hesitation, were, "I can live with that." And whether she knew it or not, she spoke great truth. She was able to live with her cancer. When she got home, I have to say it was the kids that did so much of it. I could not have had her at home alone. But our five children, by God's grace and all kinds of machinations, were able to be home with us for most of that time. We invited them just for short periods of time. We have five children. We thought she had about 3 weeks, so we planned about 3 or 4 days each that they would be with us, and certainly with her, and alone, so that they would have alone time and to do closure. And then they would overlap a little with the next one, and they all came. But then as she continued on and looked comparatively hale and hearty, she was up and about, I think, until the last 2 weeks, maybe three, that the kids start drifting back. So we had all of them there for a longer period of time, and four of them there for 6 weeks or more. One of them is in the room with us now. But I have to say, without them, it would have been possible to do that. Not only because of the work that had to be done, but of the support that we needed. But mostly it was Jenny giving us the sense of hope and courage and freedom to be who we were. She would not let anybody who came to visit her escape without talking about death. You couldn't come and just be nice to her. No way. She knew what her ministry was about, and that was to get the people to talk about it. One of her upsetnesses was the people who, she came home to die, and the people who were coming there to tell her that she wasn't going to die. They wanted her to be healed, but they wanted her to be bopped back up and zoom around and get that, somehow that intestine was going to be straightened out. And Jen would try her best, often with great patience, to say that God is healing me through death. And it was very difficult, even for some of our close friends, to accept that. But that was her ministry. She, and now I'll name drop a couple of things. These are real things to me, and I don't mean to be doing just a bragging about it, but she had already established a relationship with Dr. Joseph Sittler, whom the rest of you have heard me mention before. And Joe would come out to see her. As he said to Marty also is a friend of our family, he would come. And as Joe would say, "I got to go out and see Jenny, I need her." Because they would talk alone and talk about death and heaven, what it's like and what it's not like. And he'd give her all kinds of things, and then she'd pin him back a little bit and ask about this. And here's this woman who didn't graduate from college and was so self-conscious that she had only gone 1 year to college, taking on one of the lights of the World Council of Churches and certainly Lutheranism. And Joe dearly would get on his blind. He'd get on a train by himself to come out. And we'd find excuses to drive back in the city. "Well, Joe, we got to go right by the university." So I remember Mary took him back in once, and it was a privilege to have him around. And the same with Marty. Marty would share, often in tears, with her the insights. Always was prepared, and the most super organized man in the world. Always had something to say and a record, something to do, and that was marvelous support. The loads of people who responded to an openness about talking about death was just overwhelming. That seemed to hunger for a chance to be direct about it. And Jen came home, well, and the humor part was just fantastic. She said, "I came home to die thinking I would spend all the time having deep, profound thoughts. The first thing God had me do was darn the socks. she told Joe, she says, I want to be very profound, Joe, but all I'm doing is you're dying. She says, I wish I had something great to say. Well, she often did, but laughed at it a lot. She would, in her early times, when she was still up and about, when people would come to see her, she says, well, now, are these people I should be in bed for? So I look like I have cancer. And some folks who came to see her, she wasn't interested in having him stay that long, so she did get in bed, so they would leave very soon. And she thought they had left, so she bops out of bed and comes back in the kitchen, and there they still are in the kitchen. She was dearly embarrassed by that. The kids had her put together the room that she was in, and she had a long time ago, a friend of mine took a picture of me and blew it up sort of about this big, huge thing. And Jin Durasmi had put it into a garish gold frame and one day hung it in the living room just, you know, to make fun of me. Well, these kids found this thing and put this at the end of her bed. So here she's lying, dying, looking at this horrible picture of me up there. And some of the neighbors, the pious neighbors, came over and said, oh, what a marvelous woman. See how she loves her husband. We were going to put offering plates and candles underneath. So we rose in front of that, and that stayed in her room. It was a fun room. And she would share deeply with us, and we would make notes mentally and otherwise. And I think it was Anne, the oldest, was talking to her once and about that, and how deep it was, and how meaningful it was, and grateful that she was. And Jin said, well, maybe it's all bullshit. And after the response, then she said, but it was my deepest thoughts. We laughed a lot. Had to. It was funny. Early on, she couldn't... the biggest thing was to pass gas. And with the doctors and everybody else working on her and all kinds of things, she said, I never dreamt that the focus of my life would be farting. And how terribly important it can be. You know? She realized that. One of her doctors was terribly embarrassed by it all, but the other one was comfortable. So she enabled that, a lot of that, that to happen. Her body was very important to her. She wouldn't wear bedclothes for weeks before she died. Wanted to be touched, wanted to be massaged, and enjoyed it immensely, food and odd in ways that were unbelievable. She had experiences somehow beyond my understanding, in which the only thing I can say is somehow body, mind, and spirit came together so that she felt and saw things that I don't know about, don't understand, I don't know if the kids do either. One of the funny ones for us was, I think Tom was sitting with her. We all took, our oldest child is the organizer. She works in city government, Washington, D.C., deputy director of public works for the city. So she came home and organized us. So we all had hours and all that stuff, when to give her medications and all that. And it was Tom's turn, and about two, three days before Jenny died. And her eyes were closed as she didn't sleep a lot, but she kept them closed and was thinking, busy. And all of a sudden, she's just as I recall, in the more early in the morning, she, her eyes pops open. She says, "Oh, that's how that works." And she looked over and she says, "I just learned something," and went back and closed her eyes. We never did find out what that was all about. But just something was going on. We don't know what. There was something there, and that remains a mystery to me. It's a delightful mystery. It was not weird, it was not, you know, out of her mind or something like that, but there was something more going on. And then she had serious things to say that have been ingrained in our mind or was insights, and we're grateful for that. One of the things I shared when I was installed here, what she said to me was, Elmer, you be careful with Holden. And I first thought she said, you be careful at Holden. I would understand that. But, no, she said, you be careful with Holden. And that's remained very close to me during that whole time. She participated in writing the letter that we sent out when she died. She chose her own service. The hymns and things that she wanted done there, even arranging for our son Tom to play. He's a jazz pianist, and he played at the service. They both wanted to do it, and both were afraid to talk to each other about it, and finally were able to do that. She allowed us each to have our closure. Each of us slept the night with her in her hospital bed, each of the kids and I. And putting that together and being able to seal it so that the separation was deep, is deep, but there was a bonding more than ever we'd ever be able to achieve in 35 and a half years of marriage. It was marvelous years of imperfect marriage, the only kind you get, but marvelous years. But even the bonding of those last days. All I can say is that I think she, by doing all of those things, the ministry she had to us, not consciously, not announced or put upon us, this is stuff that had made it possible for me to survive the months without her. Miss her just deeply. Dearly want her to come back. But the strength that she had has been the gift that that each of us have received. And sharing any of that with you and questions you might have later on about it is part of, for me, carrying on that ministry that she started. That's more than 5 minutes.
I lost my dad on October 1st last year. And I was really conscious of God's time plan and all of it. We had come back to Seattle just a year and a half before, and I could slowly see him failing. And my husband would take him to the doctor, and it was just everything going wrong. You know, his body chemistry was going wrong, and he had aneurysms, and he had heart failure, and he got so he wouldn't eat, and you know, just week by week by week by week, you could see him leaving. And it was good to be with him because he was able to do a lot of review of his life, you know, about relationships he had with his brothers and sisters and places that he'd worked where he felt that they appreciated him or they didn't appreciate him. He sort of came to terms with his life. And I think he got to be sort of proud of some of the things he'd done. And finally he went to the hospital because his pulse dropped to about 20 or 30, and they put a lot of tubes and machines on him, you know, and with all those things, he could kind of come back, you know, but the minute they were taken away, his body couldn't stabilize itself at all. And so he died. None of us were there when he did die. But they called us right away from the hospital, and my husband and I had just been for a walk, and I answered the phone, and I just felt like somebody had knocked me over. I had never had a death that close to me before, and it was just like somebody had bodily hit me. It was just a jolt, a real jolt. And so we went and got Mother and told her and went up to the hospital and into his room to see him. And the only thing I could think of when I saw him was, he's not there. He's not there, you know. His body was there, but he wasn't there. It was just as clear as anything. And Elmer said, you know, Jenny seemed to be in another world sometimes. And I can remember the summer before he died, seeing him sit in the yard and watch the kids and stuff. And he had far away look in his eye, like he wasn't quite here, like he was partly someplace else, you know. And he made it easier for us. and for himself by saying, you know, I'm ready to go. I want to go. He didn't want to be hooked up to those machines anymore. It's a really hard thing to come to terms with in your head. I mean, somebody can say they're dead, you know, but in your head, they're not. You know, they're still around. They're still there. And so it isn't real for about the first, well, for quite a long time, it isn't real because, you know, you're busy with plans for the funeral and calling relatives and everything. But I can remember the first night we stayed with Mother in the house and slept there. And I was worried all night. I thought Mother was going to die too. You know, I didn't hear her get up to go to the bathroom or anything. I thought, gee, I should go in and see if she's all right, you know, because I had such a, my heart just ached. And I thought, you know, if my heart is pounding and acting like that, well, my mother must be surely in worse shape than that. But I managed to survive the night. And we, little by little, you know, we survived each day. And the friends and the church and all the cards and flowers and remembrances and all those things really help a lot more than I ever thought they would. I think you have to go through it to know it. You have to experience it, I guess, to know what it's really like. And there are many beautiful things about it. You have somebody close to you that's gone. It's already there.
Close connection.
Right.
Do you want to share?
One of the things that has amazed me for myself is learning that I'm not immortal, that I'm going to die. That I've known this in my head all along, but not my heart. And I think it's one of the things all of us are going to have to face. I mean, if I had to face it, all you guys are going to face it. And that, you know, hey, it was different when I was young and 30 years or 50 years more sounded like forever. But now, just 13 more years and I'll be 80. And I'll be lucky to hit that. Death has, you know, become real to me. Much more real at some times than the other. And maybe some of you too have had the experience that you wake up in the middle of the night and you're not quite fully awake. There are different layers, it feels like. There are more technical terms than that for it. But at that time, you know, death seems a lot closer. And we've been talking about the nicer part of death. Mm-hmm. But there are times when you feel that death is not nice. I'm sure that we all get that every once in a while. I was very much impressed by a book by C.S. Lewis called Surprised by Joy, mm-hmm. particularly by the title. Because it fits so much with my life that, you know, I don't hit those mountaintops very often. They're precious, they're tremendous when I do, but most of the time I'm down here in the valley. Well, the valley isn't so bad at that. But we need to, I certainly need to have the feeling that it's all right to be in the valley and that I don't have to be up on the mountaintop all the time. It's really a surprise and nice when I get there, but I don't have to be there all the time. When grieving, I've certainly noticed, and I'm sure you people have too, that the grieving isn't a steady level. It isn't even steady going down. You'll feel real good, and all of a sudden you drop way down, and you think, oh man, haven't I gotten out of it at all? And then I come back again. Then I'll be all be happy again. And maybe I'll feel guilty because, you know, I'm feeling too good and I shouldn't be feeling this good. I should be grieving at this time. So you can feel guilty either side of it, you know. We saw, and I was very much impressed by Elmer's telling about how lightening to the whole situation to be able to have humor and to be able to laugh, how much that meant. It's the whole purpose of laughing and humor. If you can laugh about the wolf at the door, you've already pulled his fangs. When one can't, you know, in an appropriate or inappropriate laughter, I mean, oftentimes it'll seem very inappropriate, but it sure is good. If you can share somebody else's grief, it makes you feel so close to him. You know, we felt very close to you, Elmer, because we have shared your grief. Don't be afraid of, I am, but you people shouldn't be afraid of sharing your grief with other people. And when ask people about it, ask them about, well, how did it occur? What was it like? Most of us are just tickled to be able to, once we get started, to be able to talk about it. After all, the death of a near one or our own death is the most important thing that'll ever happen to us. And, you know, if I wanted to talk about my operation, and who doesn't, how much more would we want to talk about our own death?
We just invite your response, comments, questions.
I also think it's healthy to talk about people who have died to the people who have loved them, because I brought to my attention, I don't know why I did it, but I went up to one of the widows in the church recently, and I said you know, I really miss Cal. I said, there are two or three things that happened the last few weeks of his life that I really treasure, and I told her about them, and I really remember him and cared for him, and she said, you know, nobody talks about Cal anymore. They think they'll hurt my feelings. So I think it's good to people who have died to keep them in our remembrance and in our discussions, because they are part of us.
They tell me that people who lose children, that their greatest fear is that the child won't be remembered. Mm-hmm. And so not to talk about the child. You know, I think there's even a greater sometimes sense that if you've lost a child, that people don't want to talk to you. It's just the opposite. They dearly, now there are times when they may be overwhelmed with grief, but they really want to be able to talk about that child, lest it be forgotten.
You know, that reminds me of a friend of mine that lost her son when he was about 8 from nephritis. And at that time, somehow I didn't even want to think about death, let alone children that were my children's age, you know. And so I almost prayed that God wouldn't let me have to come in contact with Dorothy, because I didn't think I could handle it, you know. Well, she moved right up near me, and I spent so much time with her. And all of the time was spent talking about Roger, you know, and Roger's death. And she would cry and cry, and I would cry with her. And I thought, thanks, God. Thanks a lot.
That's what I need.
But... you know, I can see from that people that do lose children need to talk and talk and talk and talk about them. And talk about their last illness, just like we do, even more so, I think.
When you were in the hospital with your father, what were the reactions of the people that were in the hospital with the nurses, in particular, I'm a nurse, and I deal with that a lot, and I wonder what your interactions with them were?
You know, the nurses were just wonderful. The day before he died, Ralph and I were up there, and our priest was there and prayed with them, and different chaplains came in to see him real often, which he really treasured that. But this one nurse came in, and somehow or other his potassium had gotten off, and he was supposed to drink this just awful, awful stuff, you know, and we were trying to talk him into it, and she said, "You're not fighting it." She said, "I don't like it when you're not fighting us on this. You know, I want you to have your spirit." And that was a nurse that came from the IC unit to where he had been moved, you know, on another floor. And then the nurse that was with him when he died came and talked to my mother and Ralph and I and told us how, you know, that he had a dignified death with no pain. And
did you hear that when she was saying that to you? I mean, were you, uh-huh. even the grief at that point,
yeah.
was strong?
I was still in shock. Mm-hmm. You know, so that was a meaningful thing for me to hear. That someone was with him and that his death was as he would have liked it to be. That was very comforting to know. So I was pleased with the nurses.
I can add that we had home care nurses that were marvelous. Two of them. The second one especially spent more time with us than she spent with Ginny. Because she really saw the needs that we had. To understand some things we'd ask, you know, not like, what's going to happen? You know, how do we know she's dying? And, just you know, curious things like that. And enabled us to talk a little bit among ourselves. She was good. I remember the second one, and her first visit, you know, it was pretty cold, and we stood out by the front door. And she gained enough courage to say to me, "Do you know any pastors?" I told her I thought I did. But there was whatever current. Turns out she was a very active member of the Dutch Reformed Church, trying to liberalize the Dutch Reformed Church, by the way. No small assignment. But her concern was that inclusive. It was more holistic than some of us. So, again, one was out of the hospital, one was from a doctor's office, and home care nurses. They were just fine. Please.
I want to say how much I appreciate all that you all shared with us, because it's been very helpful. I have one area I feel very inadequate in, and possibly you could give me some help. I feel at a loss when I'm visiting someone who's terminally ill and being honest and supportive and empathetic. And this is where I feel I need help.
Well, you know, with my own dad, I always stood by the bed and held his hand. And I think that's really meaningful to people, is to touch them in some way. If you're really close to them, I think it's very supportive, and it speaks more than words somehow, I think. At least, I feel that way. I don't know if the person feels that way. And I guess I feel like that when I've been in the hospital, you know, to have the doctor come in and hold my hand before surgery or something is always a specially comforting thing. What do you do?
Well, I guess I'd say the same. First of all, the touch seems to be very, very important. Maybe for both persons to feel, you know, first the visitor and the visitee. It's sort of difficult because, again, assuming you know the person well enough, if you're there, you may know the person well enough, then it seems to me to go with what your feelings are, including not only the willingness to talk about the fact that the person is going to die, and that you care about that fact, but mostly somehow to signal the caring for the person. And that's what I'm not sure what it might be. If by being concerned about their children, if someone old is dying, you show that person that you care, that might be the thing to talk about. Or if it means just that you somehow, it wasn't so much that, going back to Jenny's day, it wasn't so much she had to hear that Jesus is the resurrection and the life. She knew that. But that people cared yet about her and about her family was a sign that Jesus is the resurrection and the life. And so it, for her, again, for another person, they might want to hear. And I guess I suspect my mother-in-law, when she dies, she'll be delighted if somebody comes and says Bible passages to her. I think so. I'm not sure. But I think that might be true. That's because of a whole history in there. With Ginny, it was, well, for her, it was asking, well, what do you think it's going to be like? You know? It's really a tool to the person, is all I can say. And maybe tool to your comfort with death. I think I could be more relaxed now. I think I'd be thinking less questions. I haven't been at a hospital bed now since. I'd be asking less questions of myself being there, just because I've been there.
I guess my problem is with a friend who dying of lung cancer, mm-hmm. and has been told possibly a couple of years, mm-hmm. and doesn't want to accept it, and is fighting it every day. And I feel inadequate to be supported.
To share a little experience here at Holden, since I've been here, we had someone here who has got ALS, and after
when
some,
that is,
pardon?
What that ALS?
Oh well, Lou Gehrig's disease is what I call it. I mean, maybe there's whatever it is. It's usually you don't recover, and he was deteriorating very seriously. And he was up in years. I think he was 70-something now. And it became clear. And he wanted some healing services. We had at least one. I think we had two healing services for him here. But I was always careful in that healing service to include the possibility of healing through death. But we sat and talked a number of times. And finally, I forgot, it was Walter, I guess his name. Walt, are you ready to die? I said, Bill, I'm not talking about ALS now. But I mean, look at you. You're up in years. You're going sometime, you know. I just wanted, and he said, I said, have you thought about it? Have you talked about it with anybody? No. No, yeah. And he says, who should I talk to? I said, how about your wife? She's right here at home. Right here. So, I mean, maybe I'm getting blunt or something, but I was direct with him that, you know, how are you going to escape? So you don't go with lung cancer. You're going sometime. I don't think, no, again, I'm not trying to be a psychiatrist with that person, and you know, there's a lot of assumptions going on. I guess my observation is, I think as Christians with an element of hope, or an ounce, or whatever it may be, somehow I'd be interested in giving him a signal that there's hope.
You know, maybe she needs to deny. Maybe that's where she is, too, and maybe that's where she'll always be.
Yeah, that's true.
Because some people never can, you know, get past that stage.
In which case, you don't have to worry too much because you aren't going to break through anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you need to worry. And I was just watching how you said, how you talked bluntly to the person. Elmer used a very normal tone of voice. And that tone of voice means a lot more than what you actually say. You know, if I say, oh, I'm not scared of that at all, or who says I'm angry?
Yeah. Yeah.
You read your voice much more than you read what the words actually say. So if you can... Well, first of all, we always need to be friends before we approach something like that. It should be a given with any kind of a therapy session that you have to be friends with the person that you're talking to, or else you're going to get nowhere. And then after that, if it doesn't, you know, they're going to read your tone of voice. And if you can be very nonchalant about it, hey, you're going to, you know, I'm going to die. What about you? I keep thinking about what I'm doing and so on. And it helps me when I have to talk to patients about things like this, tell a few things of my own, hear about themselves. Mm. And, you know, talking about the symptoms that the patient has, I always like to talk about when I'm sick, how sick I really am. And I think most people do. You know, you're not supposed to, you know that.
Maybe somebody else has suggested too. You know. We're not the experts up here. We've got a narrow swatch of experience.
You said that everybody goes through grief differently, and I agree with you there. You know, one of the things I learned that as I reflect back on my grief of about 11, 12 years ago when my dad died, I would have preferred to go through the kind of grief you went through with your wife. I mean, I really would have preferred that. But that's not what happened in my case. When my dad died, there was a lot of things that weren't, there was no closure. And he died such an extremely painful death from cancer. And when he finally died, we were very glad to see him die. But a year later, I realized that, you know, I hadn't taken care of that grief. And I ended up in a very deep, deep depression. And it lasted for a long time, about 18 months. Had to work through a lot of things, you know, in my mind about the whole thing, about how there had been no closure. And I finally had to close it myself, is what it amounted to. But the thing was, I look back and I reflect on it now, and I think that it was a terrible experience to have to go through. But yet, that is where I did a tremendous amount of growing, in those deep, deep valleys. And it's probably the only time that I've ever really had what I would call a vision, a real vision of Christ being with me. I mean, you know, I've always known, just known by my faith that he's with me. But he literally stood before me in my depths of sorrow and he said, "Odette, you have shared in a part of my suffering." And that's something I never wanted to do. Mm-hmm. You know, there's these passages in the back of the Bible that you've got to suffer, you've got to share it. And it builds hope and it builds endurance. And every time I read that passage, I would think, I don't need to do this in order to, you know, to reach the altar. That finally came to me, and when he said that to me, that was very cleansing. For the first part, for the first time I realized, hey, this is what it means to be part of Christ's body. And then that's when healing finally started to play. It was just kind of a... And then I still look at that passage and I think, oh wow, I remember some awful things from that passage. But it no longer has that... It's not oppressive to me. No longer impressive than he's freed me up. So, but I would prefer to go through grief where there is closure and where you do have time to talk to people and say, you know, tell them your last thoughts. I just never could. In our family, you just never could discuss it. And it is better. I hope that I'll be able to with my children if I have that chance. You know.
But does that closure ever happen? I mean, I think, you know, with Jenny, there was a lot of talking and a lot of, but like you said, and I think that's what struck me, you said, I want her to come back.
Oh, sure.
Oh, sure.
I want her here right now.
No question. Spent time crying this afternoon about that.
Sure. So there's closure in the sense that the things we could do and we were about, we took care of, but not closure to the relationship. You know, I don't, as human being in the 35 years, she's still around. That's why I say I bump into her every day. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm glad for that. Sometimes it's very sad. And sometimes it's not. Her last 45 minutes were tough. And those are the ones we remember. Those are the ones that are ingrained. And tough.
How can you deal, what is the best way of dealing with needing a physical presence? I mean, what is most comforting when you want that person right there? Aside from crying and feeling that loss, what eases it into a comfort?
Well, for me it's been, I hope I did less than just say, would be the crying by itself has been good, and being with someone who knew Ginny is another. or being with Mary, or being with one's family, who where we have the bond of that experience. Now, I'm hoping that later on I'll be being with maybe more people, but at the moment it's still the need to be close to one who was there. Or, well, like here, Karen and Dan were back and saw Jenny in her bed, and they're part of that. And Mary certainly was a big part of it. So grateful for her to be here this year, just for those moments. But this, I've said before, make no sense. They come and go, no sense to it. It's not connected with anything. Most of the time, it's just like that.
It just washes over you like a big wave. And it just.
And there it is. And then sometimes it goes away, almost as fast. You don't appear. It could be late at night, it could be middle of the day, and it could be early in the morning. Just as, I thought maybe some pattern, some kind of thing. It makes no sense.
All of the time, I think there are times that you love
our anniversary is coming up next week.
You feel it longing with them because they were part of the celebration, and all of a sudden you feel isolated from the rest of the family because you're feeling, I feel like I'm with my mom and dad at that time so much, and it seems like everybody's celebrating, and all of a sudden you're not part of the group, you're just there alone, even though they're not there.
An interesting part of that is, if you lose an arm, it takes you about a year before that arm really disappears. It shrinks up in your mind. And finally, if you close your eyes just before it disappears entirely, just a little couple of fingers sticking out over on your shoulder. Because it's a real part of you. It's me. When I close my eyes, I know where it is. And you can't take that away from you that fast. It's got to shrink. And I'm sure that's, somebody who's close to me, my spouse, doesn't disappear immediately. Even when, you've had a lot of rough times together, and you remember those too. But they don't disappear immediately. It has to shrink up. It has to go away. Even I remember so distinctly a cat we had. We liked our cat, but after all, it was a cat. Well, we got leukemia and died. And for several days afterwards, I'd hear something and I'd look around because, there was a cat, And then as soon as I looked, I knew, it wasn't there, but I expected to see it. Well, how much more somebody you love very closely will you, for things like Elmer saying, absolutely no reason at all. All of a sudden, it'll be like, hey, we're there. And that's a part of you. And it'd be a shame, if you lost an arm and you didn't pay any attention to it. How much more? Another part of you. We are a part of each other.
One of the things I discovered in recovery from my depression was I began to change my beliefs. I began to live differently because of recovery and some of the skills I learned. And I also experienced grief when these old beliefs died. And the old patterns started to drop away. I was kind of very sad because here I was losing something I held on to all my life, basically. And then I was shedding it and saying, no, it's not going to work for me anymore. I've tried it all this time, it's not working, I want something new. And I still find, from time to time, a belief that I didn't know it was there. It comes up. Hey, that's not working. That isn't what I want. And I go through the grief process. It's not very long. It's short. But it's there. Because I'm losing part of me. Even though it was a belief. It wasn't me physically, but it was a belief that I had held on to a long time. And I really feel sorry for my poor husband because I change off every day. He's still here. Thank you for your faithfulness.
In that regard, I think closure keeps happening. I think when you talk about it,
it's easy to sound like something we did very neatly. And during that time, I felt, you know, am I doing this right? Everyone else is having such great closure with Mom. And it was hard for me. A lot of our talks were, she was painfully honest with me. And you didn't have that with your father. And I did have that with my mother, but it was also, it wasn't always easy. I'm glad for it, but that continues.
It's a great healer. I mean, it really is. Just a great old time.
And it continues for Barbara. And another thing I would add, I guess, is when dealing with someone who has a terminal illness, I think for me, initially, to be able to think of my mom is still her. The first time I talked to her, I had her in a whole other realm because she had cancer. And that took a while, I think, to just still let her be mom with the whatever that meant.
I'm really, I've been grappling in the last 4 or 5 years with a different kind of grieving. Instead of grieving both my grandmother and my father before they're gone, because my grandmother was just a downhill trip from 91, and she wasn't the same grandmother, but she was still there. My father's been really ill, and I've spent a couple of years grieving him, and I got re-hit with it again this summer because he got into a severe condition of what the doctors have, you know, just classed as literally a lack of will to live, and where he was severely physically incapacitated. But, you know, in 2 weeks they got him over that, but still doesn't have much will to live. And I've had to work a long time saying goodbye to the dad that I used to have and accepting what I have now. And it's such a confusing grief process to deal with that. And it seems really different than, you know, having somebody who's terminally ill and today they're here and 6 months they're gone. And, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, he may live to be 100, I don't know. And there are times that I really wish him dead. And then I have to deal with that. And I get so angry that he's, you know, that he's so unwilling to do anything for himself. But it could go on like that forever. And I just find that a very different kind of grief to deal with. I'm sure I have lots more to go with it, but I've been a long way through it. And when we were all together as family again, I realized how far I had come through it relative to the other members of my family. And particularly, I'm finding it very difficult to support my mother because she has not begun any of that process and doesn't want to and would like to just sweep it all under the carpet, but has been in a lot of pain for a long time living with it. I don't know if you can speak to that at all. I think that's a common situation, particularly with old people, maybe Alzheimer's or the more common situations where people were one person and then become a very different person and maybe not within their control. And everybody around them has to deal with still their presence, but grieving, you know, the passing of what they were, if that makes any sense.
And we do get angry at the person for leaving us, and particularly at a person for not wanting to stay with us. That's what really hits me, at least, with people is, hey, don't you want to stay with me? Maybe you're tired of this world, but you shouldn't be tired of me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for me, I'm in that process with my father. And I grew up and, you know, where it wasn't okay to be angry. So I've gotten to learn about those kinds of feelings that it wasn't okay for me to have or share, particularly to feel in relationship to my parents.
And of course it's all right to be angry about it. I mean, what can you do about it? But you still feel bad when you look at it.
then you feel guilt. That's so much better.
Do you think that eventually you'll be able to see him as a new person, like a child that you can love again?
Well, definitely he is a child now. And definitely I have had moments of that. I feel the worst that he is so filled with self-hate. And intellectually I handle it beautifully, and I understand it, and it's like I really believe that not too many people can do anything for him until he decides something himself. But I don't think that's going to happen. It's very frustrating to know what kind of support and what kind of acceptance to give, because I'm really tired of accepting him mumbling and bumbling and giving up on everything. You know, that's when I get into that, well, then why don't you just die? Get on with it. And that's a very frustrating place to deal with.
Can he do that now?
Well, he won't do that either. I mean, that's why I think he'll live to be 100.
But is he able to do that? Does he have the mental capability to do that? To talk about his bitterness?
Yeah, he does. And we've been through some real intensive family counseling this summer, but he's the most unwilling to look at it, and it's going to take some real hard confrontation. It's just going to be a really long road, but I don't want to trip into the fantasy that it's all going to be okay again, because I really don't think it is. I mean, I think we need to learn to deal with it in a whole new and different way, and that's what I think we're doing together as a family. As far as he has definitely the capacity to deal with that, but I don't think he likes to.
Does he have the capacity at this time to listen to your feelings on it?
I think so, and as you're talking, I'm wondering what it would be like if I went and just said, Dad, do you want to die? Or why don't you die? I have said that in anger once or twice.
Yeah.
But I don't think I would have had a sincere conversation with anyone about it, unless it was hospital staff, and he's not willing to let us know that.
Is he ill with a disease?
No, but he's done a real good job of trying to go crazy. Somebody in the other room who worked in hospitals described it beautifully. When somebody doesn't think they're worth anything, there are all kinds of ways that they can get themselves into going crazy.
Is he always at the hospital?
Pardon?
Is he always at the hospital?
No, he reached a situation where he just got impossible and decided, whether he consciously or unconsciously, I don't know, but decided not to eat, and from Tuesday to Saturday, his physical condition just completely deteriorated, and by the time he got to the hospital on Saturday, he was, at that time, all of his physical systems were affected by his not stable emotional. It's really complicated interaction between the two systems, but 2 weeks in the hospital, they got him physically functioning again. And it's just a very slow process to work through the emotions.
Is it possible he is psychotic?
Oh, he has been, definitely. I mean, and he's been on a lot of medication.
In which case, it's not going to be reasonable, anything.
That's right.
One can't expect the response to be reasonable, because
that's the definition of it. That's a very difficult part of the whole situation.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's been, and the psychiatrist really, I addressed the question of the psychiatrist, how do you know which is, when do you trust that he's rational and when do you not? And basically his answer was, the more clear people get, the more healthy they get, all of that takes care of itself, the psychosis lessons, along with medication. At least that's the way I heard him talking about it.
Is he improving?
Pardon?
Is his psychosis part, is it reducing?
Oh yeah, definitely. Psychosis has only really happened maybe twice when he's been in really severe states. But he's also a wonderful con artist, and we all know that. And it's the first time anyone's confronted him about it. It's the first doctor that he's not been able to con. So it's very difficult for us as a family.
But my whole thing, and just mention it, was just the grieving process. He's not what he used to be. And we were very, very close. And you know, I grieve for him also. I mean, I think he needs to grieve for himself in a sense. It's just a very difficult kind of grieving. It would have been easier, I think, if he had just died and I would have had to grieve, if that makes any sense. But maybe I'm just feeling sorry for myself in saying that. But I know other people who are going through the same grief too. So I think it's a pretty common kind of grief, different, but maybe more common than that.